8:25 the time. It's a Wednesday edition of the Mornings with Ed show. And just a note here that I've always said that a brand new song that I haven't seen or heard before, I'll give it a shot. I'll let it go one round and, you know, determine whether I like it or not. And I wasn't too fond of that one. Not incredibly fond of that. You'll let me know, however, if you liked it at 949-715-5936. So all morning long and really all month long, we've been talking about mental health here in our country. In 2019, 47,511 Americans died by suicide. And this year, the preliminary numbers for 2020, they show almost 45,000 people died by suicide. And I think my question to the audience is, have you ever thought about what that moment must be like? Have you wondered what that sense of utter hopelessness and desperation must feel like at that moment that someone chooses to take their own life? What must they be thinking? How badly do they hurt? Why are they doing this? Our guest this morning survived an attempt to take his own life by jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. And since we booked this conversation, the helplessness that families must feel and for me, the inability to actually completely understand that pain has quite frankly haunted me while I've gotten this stuff together. Joining us for the conversation this morning is Kevin Hines, whose despair and hopelessness drove him to this, life's most desperate act. And we are delighted that he's with us here this morning. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you very much. How are you today?
I'm very well. And I think that's the most important question you can ask someone, and certainly the most important one I'll be asking you today. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's a good mental health day today.
Okay, fantastic. I'm delighted to hear that. As I mentioned, I want to talk about everything, your childhood, the progression of the pain and darkness, and what you're doing now, obviously. But I'd like to start with that moment of that moment when you decided to kill yourself, that instant that you made the decision, when your feet left the rail of the bridge. What's happening inside of you at that moment? What's that darkness like?
Well, to be fair to people who attempt and die by suicide all around the world, it's not so much a decision like you would decide to buy a car, or you would decide to go to a particular school, or you would decide to go, get a particular job. It's more of a compulsion to take your life by sources that come from inner pain. The way I relate it is to say, you know, if I asked you, and I'm going to ask you now, what's the one thing you want to happen when you find yourself in excruciating physical pain? What do you want that pain to do? What would you like that pain to do?
I'd like that pain to go away, clearly.
You'd like that pain to go away, right? That's right. Physical pain. I argue that brain pain is at the very least 300,000 times worse than any physical pain I've ever experienced. And I promise you, I have experienced excruciating physical pain in my life, but it never once came close to the enemy I battled within, with my mental illness. And so really, what led me to the Golden Gate Bridge was paranoid delusion, hallucinations, auditory and visual, and hearing voices telling me I had to die that were seemingly not of my conscience. Imagine a third-party voice in your head that you don't recognize as anyone you know or love telling you things you have to do that you don't want to. I never wanted to take my life. I believed I had to. I believed I had no other course of action to take. I believed it was my only option because of the voices in my head. So it wasn't a decision. It was a compulsion by my brain's misaligning chemistry.
And I'd read somewhere where even on your walk to the bridge from the bus terminal, you were willing to not do it if someone had cared, if someone even looked you in the eye. Is that correct?
So this is interesting. This is very common for people who are suicidal. They'll make pacts with themselves that are very instinctual. If one person says or does this, I will. If one person says or does this, I won't die today. And my response in my mind was, if one person says, hey, kid, are you okay? Brother, is something wrong? Or pal, can I help you? Or a variation of the three, I would have broken down, told them everything, and begged them to save me. I had made that pact with myself. And on the bus, nobody said anything. They just stared at me. One guy said, "What the hell's wrong with that kid over there crying and yelling aloud at the voices in his head?" On the bridge, a woman approached me, asked me to take her picture, and several times, and I did. And she walked away, and I thought, absolutely nobody cares. The furthest thing from the truth. Everybody cared. My whole family would have been there to stop me had they known where I was, what I was doing. All my friends would have done the same. I can tell you that after I jumped and survived, I received hundreds of letters from people, some people I hadn't spoken to in 7 years, saying, "Why didn't you call me? I would have been there for you." You know, so people need to recognize that if they can find it in their willpower to say four simple but effective words to anyone willing to listen when they're suicidal, "I need help now. I need help now." They can shift and change their situation. They can be here tomorrow and every day after that.
Well put. In the 5 seconds or a little over 4 seconds that it takes to reach the water from the bridge, tell me about the change of heart. Was there a change? Was there a, "Oh my God, what did I just do?"
Well, yeah, I mean, the millisecond my hands left the rail and my legs cleared it, I had an instant regret for my actions and this absolute recognition that I just made the greatest mistake of my life and I thought it was too late. And then falling those 4 seconds, thoughts in my mind were, "What have I just done? I don't want to die. God, please save me." And I hit the water. I went down 70 feet, I opened my eyes, and I was drowning, and I swam 70 feet to the surface in one breath, praying the entire time that I would live. I remember getting closer and closer to the lit circle of water above me and thinking, "I'm not going to make it. This is where I die." And thinking, "This is it." And I said to myself, "Kevin, you can't die here. If you die here, no one will ever know you didn't want to. No one will ever know you knew you made a mistake." I broke the surface of the water. I bobbed up and down in it. And I did the one thing I've done since kindergarten that I can remember. I prayed, "God, please save me. I don't want to die. God, please save me. I don't want to die. I made a mistake." And three things happened that day to save my life. A woman driving by in a red car saw me go over the rail and called her friend in the Coast Guard. The singular reason the Coast Guard got my position in the water before I would set in hypothermia and drown was because of that woman's phone call. Wow. 3-minute window. In the water before the Coast Guard boat arrived, I kept going under the water. I could not stay above water. I was about to drown. I had an asthma attack. I was out of breath. And I kept going down because my boots were waterlogged, my long-sleeve clothing was heavy. And that's when something very slimy began circling beneath me. And I'm telling you, I freaked out. I thought, "You've got to be kidding me. I didn't die jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge, and the shark is going to eat me. Perfect." And I'm punching this thing with my right arm, but it won't go away. It's circling faster and faster. No longer am I wading in the water to stay afloat. I'm lying atop it, being kept buoyant by this creature, thinking this is one heck of a nice shark. Well, it turns out it wasn't a shark at all. It was a sea lion. And the people above looking down believed it to be keeping me at my body afloat until the Coast Guard boat arrived behind me. And I know this story because a man named Morgan wrote to me after I was on a TV show where I said I thought it was a shark. And he said, "Kevin, I was standing less than 2 feet away from you when you jumped. Until this day, watching this show, no one would tell me whether you lived or died. It's haunted me until now. By the way, Kevin, there was no shark like you mentioned on the show, but there was a sea lion, and the people above looking down believed it to be keeping your body afloat until the Coast Guard boat arrived behind you." Wow. And then at the hospital, one of the foremost back surgeons on the West Coast opted to do my surgery. And it was one of the first and only of its particular kind. He invented it for my situation. Nobody else has ever had this surgery after me, and nobody had it before me. And he saved me the ability to stand, walk, and run. Of the 39 Golden Gate Bridge jump survivors, 26 remain alive today. Many have died of natural causes or old age. 19 have come forward to say, like me, they had the same instant regret that I did. That's the majority, by the way. And only 5 of us get the privilege to stand, walk, and run. They actually call us the most exclusive survivors club in the world. There's a book of the same name by Ben Sherwood. And so I see life differently today. Right. I get to be here. Right. And getting to be here is a privilege and a gift, in my opinion.
And it's a gift for everyone that you're sharing your story with. And I got to say that regarding the sea lion, just a sign that all living things show empathy, and what an empathetic move from another living thing. Talk to us about the treatment for epileptic seizures that you had as a kid. You were on Tegretol for a while that controlled your seizures, but it masked bipolar disorder.
Yes. Wow, this is a great interview you've done. You've done your homework. Most people don't even know that. Yes, I've been diagnosed with epilepsy in fourth grade. I had a grand mal seizure in fourth grade in front of all of my classmates. I literally fell into I think her name was Sarah Buis Lapp, because I was having a seizure, and then fell onto the ground after that. It felt like an alien was taking over my body. It was the weirdest feeling I think I've ever had in my life, having a grand mal seizure. It wouldn't be the last, but it was the first. And so I was put on Tegretol. And back then, folks didn't know that Tegretol was actually also a mood stabilizer and an antidepressant. So from fourth grade on, it was masking any symptoms of potential bipolar disorder, which is by diagnosis. At 16 and a half / 17, they took me off of Tegretol rather abruptly. And it's a fast-acting medication, so...
Now, they took you off because your seizures were done? They had been under control?
Yeah, they deemed that I was not going to have any more seizures. They saw some repairing in the brain due to the medication, and they took me off the meds, and I immediately fell into psychosis and complete mental breakdown and disarray. I'm like, at 17 and a half, I stood in front of a 1,200 person audience at Archbishop Reardon High School performing in a theater show. And I had a complete mental breakdown in front of 1,200 people. I ran off stage, ran to the lobby, ended up seeing my first psychiatrist. I was a mess. So the medication for epilepsy was hindering my bipolar disorder from appearing.
And you were adopted as an infant. Do you know anything about your biological parents? And I'm curious if there's a predisposition for bipolar.
Yes, this is really important. So it is genetic. So both my biological parents have been diagnosed with manic depression, what we today call bipolar disorder. They coped in their day with drugs and alcohol. I coped by being in denial and trying to fight it emotionally, but not well. And my birth parents, I didn't get to know them because I was taken away from them as an infant. They fought for custody of me against Pat and Debbie Hines. They lost, partially because my birth dad accosted an undercover police officer outside the courtroom hearing. And he was killed, but he was also on drugs when that happened. And my birth mom, she passed away very tragically as well due to drugs and alcohol.
Sorry to hear that. So right now, today, what are you doing differently? What kind of support system did you surround yourself with at first? And how did that guy from back then become this guy that I'm talking to now?
You know, it all started changing in my third of nine psych ward stays in 14 years. My third involuntary stay, the next six were voluntary. I walked in and said, I need to be here, I won't be here. In my third of nine psych ward stays, my Uncle George comes to see me. He's my uncle on my mom's side. And he basically looked at me and said, Kevin, do you want to be in and out of these places for the rest of your life? And I said, no, Uncle George. He said, well, get it together, kid. We're counting on you. And he dropped a Time Magazine article on the table on how to fight bipolar disorder, depression, and mental illness with routine and regimen and win. And I read the article, and I built my own mental health regimen and routine. And I followed it ever since. And even though I've been back to the psych ward six more times, I walked in myself. I asked for help because I was self-aware with my diagnosis. And that's when things really changed, where when I realized that I had to follow this routine, follow this regimen, and be in some control of my own action. And I realized today, while I live with regular thoughts of suicide, that my thoughts don't have to become my actions. And that's how I've stayed alive for 20 years. And my thoughts don't have to own, rule, or define what I do next. They can simply be my thoughts. And if I ask for help to enough people, someone is going to be willing to help me. And that's always been the case. Every time I've been suicidal, I've been with different people. It's been in different situations. But when I say I need help, maybe it's not the first or second person that says, I got your back. But it's always someone who says, let me help you get to safety. Right now, today, you know, I went from being the kid who was so mentally unstable for so long, who had all these ups and downs, all these hospital stays. But I've been 2.5 years out of a hospital stay, so it's been going really well. I still have all my symptoms, but I'm in control of them. And when they happen, I work really hard to get out of them. I exercise, I eat healthy, I educate myself as to my diagnosis, I educate my family and friends as to my diagnosis and my struggles. I use coping strategies that help me stay stable. I refrain from drugs and alcohol. I go to therapy twice a month via teletherapy. I utilize other forms of therapy like art therapy and music therapy and light box therapy and breathwork therapy. I do everything I possibly can for my better brain health. And the way anyone can learn how to do that for me, because I want to give my tools away to the world, is if you just go to youtube.com/Kevin Hines and type in the Art of Wellness 2.0, you'll see a video there, 10 steps, 10 easily digestible steps to bettering your brain, mind, behavior, mental and health and well-being, and your physical health and well-being. And those steps are common sense tools for better brain health. They're science-backed, evidence-informed, and they should help you change your life. People are saying from as far as Peru, Africa, China, Japan, that these steps are changing their lives, and they're seeing a dramatic improvement in their mental health in 6 to 9 months of following these steps. It's like a full-time job. Right. If you want to be well mentally, you have to put in the work.
Right. And we're gonna hit that YouTube page up repeatedly here on the program. And I'll ask you again about it before we end our conversation. So there's a definite fear of slipping back. There's the possibility that you may at some point slip. So you're doing everything possible not to do it. What might some of the situations be that might trigger slipping back? What do you try to avoid the most?
You know, I try to avoid very loud places, like with a lot of people. I know that sounds odd, giving me being a public speaker and all, but when I go to do a speech and there's a lot of people talking, I center myself. I sit down and I'll do a lot of deep breathing exercises, resonance breathing. I'll inhale 4 seconds through my nose, hold for 4 seconds, release 8 seconds, like purse lips, like whistle the nose down. I'll do that, you know, 20 or 30 times before I speak, so I can keep my body in a calm, because it's hard for me to be in a place with a lot of people. It's triggering. Hearing voices is a big part of my problem. My struggle. And sometimes those voices can get confused. The auditory hallucinations can get confused with actual real people's voices. And so that's been really tough over the years to deal with that. The next thing is falling into a paranoid delusion is really a struggle. You know, going into, let's say, a Walmart or a Walgreens, or, you know, going to pick up my medication and being where people are, getting paranoid that bad things will happen. That's always been an issue with me. When it becomes overwhelming, I can't even function. I can't talk to you. I couldn't talk to my wife. I would just be, I become a total, I can fall into catatonia almost, because of my paranoia. So I really have to be aware of that. And it hasn't happened to that extreme in a long time, which has been nice. So I really focus on making sure that if I become paranoid, I'll tell my wife immediately and we'll leave the situation. We'll just walk out, get in the car, take a breath, do the resonance breathing, and bring myself back to a calm. When I'm fighting with my depression, one of the things I do is I drop my wife will go, okay, drop and give me 50 push-ups. So I'll just drop and do push-ups because it helps me balance out what I'm going through. Or I'll go for a run, or I'll go for a nice walk with my wife, or I'll lift some weights. Do something physical to get yourself out of the depressive mood is really the name of the game.
Right. And obviously the push-ups are helping you physically as well, because you look great. I'm looking at a picture of you right now, man. You're looking pretty good. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Kevin Hines, who years ago survived a jump from the San Francisco Bay Bridge and now spends his time traveling the world and helping others in crisis. Kevin, I want to ask you quickly some questions about family and families of those who have taken their lives. You've no doubt talked with hundreds of parents who've lost children to suicide.
Yeah.
Talk to us about the shattering of families and what kind of signs should parents be looking for in their kids, and how early should they be looking for signs?
So in doing this for 20 years now, I've talked to thousands of families that have lost loved ones to suicide, especially teens. And the signs you want to look for are rapid changes in behavior. So if they talk a lot and they go to talking very little, that's a sign. If they talk a little and they start talking rapidly, that's a sign. If they're sleeping only a little bit and they start sleeping a lot, that's a sign. Vice versa is a sign. If they give away all their prized possessions like I did to their family and friends, those are big signs. If they say things like, I just don't like this life anymore. I don't want to be here anymore. I hate living. I hate this existence. Those are all signs. I did all of those things. Those are my signs. And people didn't catch them because no one in my family was taught suicide prevention techniques. No one knew what the deal was. And that's not their fault. They didn't realize because how can you realize something you're not educated in? You know, it's all really easy to say when it's already happened. I should have done this and I should have done that. But you can't hold that guilt on your back. That guilt doesn't belong to you. And one thing I want to say to all the families that are listening, that have lost someone to suicide, is I learned very early on. I'm just so you know, I'm not just an attempt survivor. I'm a Golden Gate Bridge attempt survivor, but I'm also a lost survivor. I have lost 11 people I care about to suicide. Some of them I love dearly. And I've lost 11 people now. That's 11 people too many. And I can tell you that I've stopped asking the question why. It's an unanswerable question. You must instead ask yourself the question how. How do I look to the living to move forward? How do I look? Because I don't think you can move on from a suicide. I don't think that's possible. I don't think that's humanly possible, moving on. I think you can look to the living, those who still remain here, and find ways to move forward through the pain.
You and I share a friend. I have a dear lifetime friend in Pennsylvania who lost her son and her husband to suicide. And like you, Kevin, she managed to put her life back together by helping others. So together with your wife, Margaret, you've started the Kevin and Margaret Hines Foundation. Tell us how you're helping others, and talk to us a little bit about Margaret and how you guys met.
Absolutely. So, we founded the Hines Foundation to give back to people in pain. We give out free therapy, free teletherapy to youth that otherwise couldn't afford it. We also give scholarships to youth to become who want to get going to the suicide prevention field as we go to different conferences around the country and the globe. We founded the organization to really make a difference in people's lives and affect change in suicide prevention. And I met my wife in my third psych ward stay, the same place I had my epiphany, and I had my gift, and she was the gift. I was in there for 2 months. None of my family or friends would house me or take me back. I needed to get well on my own. And I'm in there for 2 months, and one day, a month in, comes this kid on the gurney. He's catatonic. He can't move and he can't talk. And he had overdosed on methamphetamine. Well, they would wheel him into the cafeteria every day for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and he wouldn't eat because he couldn't move. And they would take his tray away full, and always made me very angry. And so I just would sit with him and I'd talk with him. I'd tell him stories after story. My plan was to elicit a response. Well, 2 weeks into talking to him, he looks up at me and kind of He hasn't moved or blinked once, but he moves up and he goes, "Geez, man, you talk too much. Leave me alone." And that's the whole life story for me. You know, it was great. I got him to respond and finally move. The whole cafeteria was clapping. It was amazing.
That's awesome.
Well, you know, the very next day, I go to my case manager and I say, "Listen, you know, you've got me on 10 forms of therapy a day. Give me 5 forms of therapy and something productive to do. I want a job." She goes, "You want to volunteer for the psych ward you're staying in?" I said, "Yes." She said, "No, that's highly unethical and probably illegal. That's not going to happen, Kevin." I said, "Okay." And then the next day, she went on vacation, and the new case manager came in, and this lady was a total San Francisco hippie, like from 1960 San Francisco, the whole 9 yards. She had tie-dye shirt on, flowers around her neck. I mean, it was wild. And I went to her, and I said, "Hey, I'd like to volunteer for the hospital." She said, "That sounds like a lovely idea." And so she gives me all these volunteer jobs in the psych ward, which were totally against protocol. I mean, I was filing patient binders, okay? but nonetheless, she gives me my next job. Clean out the giveaway clothes closet. When you leave the hospital, you get something to wear. Everyone in the hospital is wearing hospital gowns, hospital pants, and hospital slippers with the grips on the bottom. But not me. I come out of that closet with a Ralph Lauren double-breasted polo suit and a 70s yellow flag collar, like some kind of gangster owns the place. And the next day, I'm wearing a pink polo shirt with khaki cargo shorts and sandals from the giveaway clothes closet. And I get a tap on my left shoulder while I'm giving the afternoon visiting hour announcements on the PA system, which they allowed me to do. And I get a tap on my left shoulder. I turn around, and there she was. Her name was Margaret, and I was done. I knew she'd be the rest of my life. I didn't say that to her because that would be really awkward. But I knew it. And she said, "Excuse me, do you work here?" Just like that. And the entire staff was there behind the counter, and they looked at me like, "What is this little jerk going to say?" And I said, "As a matter of fact, miss, I am a volunteer." And she said, "I'm looking for my cousin. His name is," and it was that kid. And I said, "Madam, right this way." And I walked her there, but he sees me, and I ducked out into the hallway, and I hear her say, "Your nursing staff is so nice." And he goes, "That guy? That guy's a nutball. That guy jumps off bridges. Don't talk to that guy." And I walked, "Excuse me, it was one bridge. It was one, plural. That's ridiculous." And so she goes, "Why'd you lie to me?" I said, "Margaret, I didn't lie to you. I am a volunteer at this very hospital. I just happen to also live here." Well, you know, during his stay there, Margaret comes in every day. I stopped her at the door. I said, "Margaret, when I get out of here, can I take you to coffee?" And she looked at me and she goes, "Oh, honey, hell no." You know, after she looked at the psych ward I was in, you know.
Right.
Anyway, I get out of the hospital, and I would spend a lot of time with their family because, you know, my family and I were on the outs.
Right.
I spent a lot of time with their family. And one day I called her from my halfway home, and I said, "You know, Margaret, I'd like to take you to dinner." And she was like, "I don't know." I said, "You know, one day if it goes south, you never have to see me again." Well, I can tell you it was the most horrific date you can possibly imagine. I got lemon juice in her eye. I spilled hot butter onto her chest between her blouse. I got marinara sauce all over my white shirt.
See, that's when you know it's love.
That's, you know, it said, "Check, please." You know, and we get back to her apartment, and she was like, you know, we go to the roof, and there's these two yoga mats in a box garden, and the moon is just brightly shining. And she turned to me and she says, "So tell me your story." I'm telling her my story. She fell asleep in 5 minutes. We actually fell asleep on the top of the roof in the cold. We woke up super early in the morning, and she gave me a second date. And the rest is history.
That's fantastic. I love that story. Kevin, if someone's listening right now, what can someone that's listening do that's going to have the biggest effect, the biggest impact today? What can someone out there do?
Okay. If you have any inclination that someone you love or care for is suicidal, do not hesitate or be afraid to ask the direct question, "Are you thinking of killing yourself? Have you made plans to take your life? Do you have the means?" Those three questions are key. As a matter of fact, the crisis text line, their algorithm has determined that asking the question, "Are you thinking of killing yourself?" is more effective and gets more truthful answers than the question, are you thinking of suicide? So ask the particular question, are you thinking of killing yourself? Then wait for the answer. Then are you thinking, then have you made plans to take your life? Wait for the answer. Do you have the means? Wait for the answer. If all three of those answers are yes, you need to take immediate action and get that person to a safe place. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be simple. But sometimes it's all about being with them physically, letting them know you care, letting them know you've got their back and they're not alone. Saying to them, you know, I'm right here, not going anywhere, you're safe, let's keep you safe from yourself, let's plan on future engagements, like, you know, let's go to coffee next Friday, let's do this next week, you know, give them something to live for, give them something to hold on to, okay? So one of the things you can do is you can text the crisis text line, CNQR to 741-741, that's CNQR, Courage, Normalize, Question, Recovery. Courage to talk about your mental health, normalize the conversation of it. Ask the questions, are you thinking of killing yourself? Have you made plans to take your life? And do you have the means? And recovery, because it's possible, I'm living proof. So CNQR to 741-741, the crisis text line. And what you want to say to them is, I have someone who's suicidal and I don't know what to do, and let them respond from there. Another thing you can do is download on someone's phone who you think is in danger of suicide the Not OK app, N-O-T-O-K app, A-P-P. The Not OK app lets you opt in 5 personal protectors to be there for someone who is not OK mentally. And the second they're not OK mentally, they're thinking of suicide, they press one button and 5 people are notified. They're told where they are, the situation they're in, and what kind of help they need. So please consider that as well. Those are some great resources you can use right now.
This is the most important conversation we've had in a long time. Kevin Hines, thank you so much for sharing your story with the world and with our audience this morning. It's been an honor to speak with you.
Thank you so much for having me, and I really appreciate it. It's been great speaking with you, too. For those of you who are interested, I just released my newest book called The Third Rail, In My Mania I Became. You can find it at thethirdrailbook.com, and that's with the numbers 3RD, not spelled out. So the 3RD, railbook.com.
Thank you so much. Kevin Hines, everybody. It's the morning
Thank
for that
you.
Show. Thank you, Kevin.